From Indiana to Texas, Wyoming to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the U.S. Senate held confirmation hearings this past week for a number of President Trump's cabinet nominees. For a look at the process, we talk with Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation. The traditions and pageantry of a presidential inauguration are set to get underway as Donald Trump takes the oath of office. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Rebuilding in the wake of the California wildfires will be complicated by state policies that have resulted in underinsured homeowners. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine report. And Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary on President Trump's threats against Hamas that drove them to the bargaining table. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Trump's cabinet nominees, including Secretary of State-designate Marco Rubio and Attorney General-designate Pam Bondi, appeared at confirmation hearings this past week. To learn more about the confirmation process, we turn to Zach Smith. He is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Zach, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Zach, President-elect Donald Trump has made a number of selections, almost all of his selections, in fact, for his cabinet and top positions in the federal government. They now must go through a confirmation process. Can you give us a bit of an overview as to what a nominee for cabinet secretary or high-level position might expect as they go through this process?
Sure. So the reason we have this advice and consent process from the Senate is because the Constitution requires that anyone who serves as a principal officer of the United States must be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And because obviously the president's cabinet members qualify as principal officers, they have to go through this nomination and appointment and advice and consent process. Now, in terms of the process itself, it has looked very different throughout the course of our nation's history. But today, I think it's become the television spectacle that many of us are all, unfortunately, in some ways, too familiar with, where you have senators often asking the nominees questions, members of the opposition party, in this case, the Democratic Party, typically tend to ask gotcha-type questions with the hope, I think, of sinking some of the president's nominees. But so far, things have looked relatively good for President Trump's nominees, and there's hope that at the end of the day, the confirmation process will ultimately be relatively smooth sailing for these incoming officials.
And, of course, the top four cabinet positions include Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of the Treasury, and, of course, the Attorney General. And Attorney General started off on a bit of a wrong foot, but looks like it's on track. Can you review for our listeners what has occurred with that nomination?
Well, obviously, right out of the gate, President Trump announced his intent to nominate Congressman Matt Gaetz to be the Attorney General shortly thereafter. It looked like Gaetz didn't have the votes to get confirmation, so he withdrew from that process.
And in his place, Donald Trump nominated Pam Bondi.
For those unfamiliar, Pam Bondi nominated Pam Bondi to be the Attorney General.
She served for a number of years as a local prosecutor, and served for a number of years as a Attorney General, and served for a number of years as Attorney General.
In the actual nuts and bolts of prosecuting cases, as well as
The Justice Department had been engaged in a number of lawfare, as it's been called, exercises against
President
Trump.
And as we look at that, of course, now the Justice Department is in charge, and Pam Bondi will be in charge.
Can we look for rapid reform there? And also, doesn't the FBI come into play here?
Now he, of course, has made a nominee.
Pam Bondi will be FBI director as well.
Can we look for rapid reform there? And also, doesn't the FBI come into play here? The president has made a nominee for FBI director as well.
That will rescind some of the hope for some. Who's changes the Biden on day one. I suspect Donald Trump and his team have a number of executive orders in normal lawmaking that will rescind some of the Constitution requires.
So in that sense, the Biden administration will try day one unilaterally action. President Trump without going through the normal lawmaking executive orders that the Constitution requires.
So in that sense, I think you will see day one action.
The President Trump rescinding the majority of people who work in the Justice Department enjoy civil service protection.
So that's one of the reasons
that will likely take some civil service reform.
Keep in mind, the majority of people who work in the Justice Department, like the majority of people who work in other federal personnel, enjoy civil service policy.
So that's one of the reasons that will take time for Donald Trump to get personnel have been such a hot topic of conversation.
Because at the end of the day, if you believe that personnel
in his first term, Zach, the president was undermined in a lot of cases by the permanent bureaucracy, the deep state. This time around, do you see a different approach shaping up?
Yeah, I do.
Look, I think certainly as executives from the first term and carrying over into the folks who work there, Donald Trump and his team are much more aware
of where
first
term, Zach, the president was undermined in a lot of cases by the permanent bureaucracy, the deep state. This time around, do you see a different approach shaping up?
Yeah, I do.
And also this past week, Secretary Designate for the Department of Defense, Pete Hegseth, at his confirmation hearings, it was interesting, Zach. Pete Hegseth made a comment during those hearings that he doesn't look like past nominees for the post, that he wants to have a different approach to the Department of Defense. Are we seeing President Trump appointing people who are, for lack of a better term, in terms of timing, disruptors who are going to bring about now taking office? Is it typical
the bureaucracy
that the
as
cabinet
well?
Secretaries
yeah,
aren't
I think
all
so.
In
I
place?
Think that's certainly the goal. You know, Pete Hegseth comment. His nomination hearing also
to try to move things as quickly as possible.
Understanding the urgency, understanding the DOD over the past several administrations for years,
generally speaking, not to accomplish many of his goals. So
what you've seen Donald Trump do, he's nominated a number of individuals to process as quickly as possible. And I do experiences that the nominees have not yet been confirmed.
Slightly different resumes than we're used to seeing coming out.
We have been talking with Zach Smith, who is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Zach, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where folks can go. You've written on this and other topics. Where can folks find
that? Not only is this, you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at TZ Smith. We're serious about placing Smith power.
You can also go to heritage.org to see all the great stuff my colleagues and myself have written away as well.
Of course, for those unfamiliar, Heritage is the nation's largest and most widely supported conservative think tank.
We have been talking with Zach Smith, who is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Zach, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where folks
Zach
can go.
You've written
on
Heritage
and other
Foundation.
Topics.
Zach,
folks thank you so
that.
Much for being
sure,
with
you
us.
You can follow
me
on X, formerly Twitter, at TZ Smith. That's at TZ Smith. You can also go to heritage.org, see all of the great stuff my colleagues and myself have written as well. And of course, for those unfamiliar, Heritage is the nation's largest and most widely supported conservative think tank, with my focus in particular being on courts and the criminal justice system.
Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation. Zach, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. They are based in Washington, D.C., where the nation's capital is getting set for the inauguration of the 47th president of the United States, Donald Trump. We're going to talk about that with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
So as we look to the inauguration here, Scott, what is going to unfold? There's usually a lot of pomp and circumstance, a lot of ceremony, and apparently a lot of celebration going on in the Capitol.
Well, we're definitely expecting the same thing. This weekend, we've got all sorts of inaugural festivities that are taking place and some of the early balls. And, you know, we're actually expecting some snow in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. And on Monday morning, they're calling for really, really chilly weather. It's supposed to be a high of 21 right now. And, you know, I would expect during the inauguration itself, it will be in the low teens to mid-teens. And that's going to be the coldest inauguration since Ronald Reagan in 1985. And that's not going to damper the attitude and excitement in Washington to have Donald Trump coming back into office. There's a lot of America First MAGA patriots that are ascending to Washington now. I was downtown this week. There's already an enormous buzz, not just on Capitol Hill, but in restaurants and bars and all over the city. I think that there's just a tremendous excitement to sort of turn the page on the economic malaise we've experienced underneath the Biden administration and really get back to sort of this entertainment and the personality of Donald Trump that extends all throughout his administration. We've got Carrie Underwood that's going to be singing on Monday. And, you know, for all of us football fans, you know, we've been saying we've been waiting all day for Sunday night. Well, we've been waiting 4 years for the inauguration of Donald Trump.
It's interesting this time around, Scott, if you compare it looking back to 2017. In 2017, there was a lot of sort of standoffishness when it came to Donald Trump. It was a shocking upset that he beat Hillary Clinton, and the resistance was at a very high point. This time around, to me, and you can talk a bit about this, it seems more normal, if you will, the way we're doing this transition.
Well, that's certainly a good thing, right? And I think with the death of Jimmy Carter, a lot of people saw his funeral at the National Cathedral. Trump and Obama were seated next to each other because Michelle Obama, who would normally sit between two presidents, skipped the funeral because she apparently didn't want to sit next to Trump. But they were yucking it up and laughing. And, you know, we've all seen sort of the lip-reading memes that have come out from that. And, you know, I think that there will be sort of a return to the historic norms and precedent of a handover of power. However, Michelle Obama has said she's going to skip the inauguration. So it'll be interesting to see how Obama handles the ordeal, sort of being there by himself. But, you know, setting aside the Democrats and really looking forward to Republican unified government, Trump's going to come out of the gate on Inauguration Day. I think he's going to sign a bunch of important executive orders, rolling back these harmful, regulations and orders that Biden has promulgated and issued throughout the last 4 years. I think, the administration's new policies will make an immediate difference on day one. And there's Democrats that are really, really concerned about that. We read this week that a lot of the sort of veterans from the Biden and Obama and Clinton administrations are forming coalitions to stand up a communications arm against what President Trump is going to be doing. And it's not like they even know exactly what's going to happen, right? They're just going to be these partisan blowhards on MSDNC and other legacy media and just trashing every move that Trump takes. But I think that for everybody that's out there listening, we've just got to be able to judge the next 4 years from the previous 4 years and decide in 4 years whether we were better off or not. And that's how I sort of looked at the first Trump administration compared to the 4 years we endured of Joe Biden as president, the weaponization of government. All that's going to go away. And I'm just, tremendously excited for what this week and the next 4 years is going to bring to the United States of America.
Well, no doubt a new day is dawning in Washington, D.C. And in many ways, Scott, it's as if Donald Trump has really been the de facto president of the United States ever since Election Day for the last couple of months, because world leaders and national opinion leaders, influencers have been making their way to Mar-a-Lago, interestingly, including John Fetterman. And John Fetterman, of course, is U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, my home state. So we've had a front row seat to him. Interesting to see the friendship that seems to be budding between Donald Trump and John Fetterman. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting, no doubt about it. When Fetterman got elected, there were a lot of questions about his own abilities following his stroke. But I think the reality is that he sort of turned out to be the next Joe Manchin of the United States Senate for Senate Democrats. He has committed to supporting several of the Trump nominations. And he says, I'm a senator for all Pennsylvanians, and my job is to get out there and try to find common ground with any administration. And I think that's sort of a breath of fresh air for a lot of people to hear, the devil will be in the details and the evidence of what he actually does to work with the Trump administration. But there should be some optimism, and I think that we'll see that right away with the nominations. And I think Fetterman will be in play to vote with Republicans on the reconciliation package, because look at the bottom line of what it's going to do in terms of closing our border and increasing border security, and also, you know, reducing the level of taxation on all Americans in the middle class, which will make a fundamental difference with inflation and economic growth and productivity. Really, really important things that I think Pennsylvanians care about. The bottom line is, Loman, that groceries and the cost of living, the cost of energy are big, big issues to Pennsylvania. Those can be addressed within the reconciliation package. So it's going to be interesting to see whether Fetterman supports that. We're expecting final passage sometime around Easter. And I know that you and I are going to be talking a lot with the listeners about budget reconciliation, energy, illegal immigration, and the economy in the months ahead.
Right now, it's a celebration weekend and the inauguration of President Donald Trump, but a lot of work lies ahead, and we will work our way through all of that with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in the mission of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity, and making sure that we have a limited government that adheres to our constitutional responsibilities. If you want to learn more about us, then check us out at clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Many of the homes destroyed in the California wildfires are underinsured because of bad state policies. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine explain.
By now, I'm sure you've seen the footage of the horrific, just devastating wildfires that have consumed so much of Los Angeles, the area around Los Angeles, over the past week or so. The latest death toll for the fires is 24. That number almost certainly will rise. Perhaps even by the time you're listening to this, it will have risen. The property damage total is sure to be astronomical when they get done adding it all up. And even though this is still very much an ongoing story, the fires are still burning, the wind is still blowing, the situation is not yet fully contained. I think it's also important to sort of look ahead a bit and also backwards a bit to see how the rebuilding process after an event like this will be helped or hindered by some of the state policies that have been in place for a while. And that's what we're going to get into today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christian Britschke. He's a colleague of mine at Reason Magazine, a reporter for us, and he's written quite a bit over the past few days about the policy implications of these just devastating wildfires in LA. Christian, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Really glad to have you here. Let's start with a piece that you wrote last week. The headline on this one is California's insurance regulation fixes came too little too late. Again, people can find this at reason.com. We don't have time to get through all of it here, but really, if you can, in a nutshell, take me through the restrictions that California's placed on homeowners insurance, because it seems like that's a serious factor here. A lot of people don't have enough insurance to potentially rebuild after something like this.
Yeah, so California has two important restrictions on insurers' ability to raise premiums. One is they can only factor in like past losses from wildfires, and they have to average those past losses over the past 20 years, which obviously gives you a lower figure than the wildfire risk people currently face, given that wildfire risks are going up and the risks are concentrated in more recent years. And on top of that, insurers aren't able to factor in the cost of reinsurance when they set premiums, and reinsurance is just insurance on insurance, which has been going up to reflect those increased wildfire risks. And so what you have is a situation where insurers can't charge, you know, accurate premiums to their customers. And so what they've done instead is just start trying to limit their business that they do in the state. You know, the state's two largest insurers, State Farm, Farmers, said last year that they would stop issuing new policies, accepting new customers. There's been a huge surge in non-renewals of policies, and there's also been a large uptick in the amount of people who can't find any private insurance and therefore have to go on the state's high-risk plan or the FAIR plan, which, as you know, a lot of coverage has put it out, only covers $3 million in property, which, you know, for some very expensive California homes and a lot of the homes affected by these fires is not enough to cover the entire value of the property. The FAIR plan itself only has a few billion in reserves is what its own officials have said. And they've also said that, you know, if there is a big event, which we've now experienced, it's going to require a massive assessment, meaning that the plan is funded by the state's private insurers collectively. And if it doesn't have enough money to pay out, then it'll need to levy an assessment on those insurers and in effect on policyholders. So regular policyholders are going to be in a position where they're going to have to bail out this state high-risk plan.
Yeah, the money's got to come from somewhere. That's always the case. I want to go back to something you said in your first answer there, too, about the way California structures this requirement for what insurers are allowed to look at. I mean, it seems to me somewhat contradictory that you have a state that has taken so many actions in recent years with an eye towards climate change, you know, trying to reduce emissions, things like that, with the sense that climate risks are getting greater. And then on the other hand, you've got this state policy, you know, enacted by the same politicians that effectively says, well, you can't take into effect that greater risk. That's literally what insurance is, right? Is pricing risk. Those two things just don't seem to go together to me. Am I missing something, or is this really like a glaring contradiction here?
Well, I mean, it is a contradiction. You know, far be it for me to defend California politicians, but I guess to give them their due, the real villains are the voters from 40 years ago. You know, these limitations were established by voters in a ballot initiative passed in 1988. And in order to change that ballot initiative, you have to get two-thirds approval in the legislature and then pass another successful ballot initiative in order to permanently amend California's insurance restrictions. Now, the state, because the situation has gotten so bad and insurers were basically ready all to leave the state, Gavin Newsom has exercised emergency authority to allow the insurance commissioner to come in and issue some emergency regulations that give insurers more flexibility about reinsurance, about using kind of forward-looking catastrophe models when pricing their insurance. But even that is kind of an open question of whether he has the legal authority to do it. So the state certainly has itself in a bind. It is certainly has contradictory policies when it comes to being proactive on climate change in one sense, but then not allowing insurers to factor in climate change into their own policies in another sense. But it's not necessarily politician A holding both views in his mind at the same time, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, fair enough. It was the voters a while ago. This is like the classic case of setting price controls, right? Just like rent control, it benefits people at the time. You don't necessarily take into account the consequences that'll happen down the road. That seems to be what's gone on here.
If I could say too, you know, it's the worst price controls are the price controls you put on insurance, because, you know, with rent control, you know, you limit the price, but, you know, the market still exists to some extent, whereas the housing still exists. The only purpose of insurance is to provide a price based on the risk that, you know, a property or, you know, a policyholder faces. And so when you control that price, you almost make the policy, you know, the whole market meaningless.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we've seen with the insurers leaving the market. But I think that's a great point. And Christian, thanks for taking some time with us, man. Really important topic here, and thanks for walking us through it.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, thanks to Christian. You can check that out. Again, that's at reason.com. That's Christian's newsletter this week. Also, you can subscribe to his newsletter there. Rent Free is the name of it. Check it out on our website and get it right in your inbox. Find it there. Of course, we send our thoughts and prayers to everybody out there affected by the devastating fires in and around the Los Angeles area. Hopefully things take a turn for the better in the near future here, and they're able to get that whole situation more under control. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In the wake of President-elect Donald Trump's threats against Hamas, the terror group has at least tentatively agreed to a ceasefire and hostage release. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
We are mere days away from January 20th, 2025, the second inauguration of Donald Trump as America's 47th president. It is much anticipated by all, with some jubilant and others, well, you know, dreading the moment. But it ought to be much anticipated for a remarkable deadline that Donald Trump has given for that day. It was a deadline that he gave during a wild press conference on January 6th. Like so many Trump episodes, that press conference was at times entertaining and at other times kind of surreal. It included moments of downright insanity. Trump talked about everything from seizing the Panama Canal and Greenland to renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America and even making Canada 51st state by use of quote-unquote economic force, if necessary. I nearly wrecked my car when I heard that one. But with all that said, I was particularly struck by a remarkable threat and deadline that the incoming president made to Hamas at that press conference. Donald Trump's most striking statement was his vow that if the hostages still being held in Gaza by Hamas are not released by the time of his January 20th inaugural, quote, all hell will break out in the Middle East, unquote. Trump made a direct threat, quote, it will not be good for Hamas, he said. All hell will break out. I don't have to say any more, but that's what it is. Wow. It was an extraordinary statement. For me, as a Reagan scholar, and for a lot of Americans, it harkens back to what happened on January 20th, 1981, at the time of Ronald Reagan's presidential inauguration. For 444 days, 52 American hostages had been held captive by Islamist fanatics in Tehran. And yet, the very moment that Reagan swore the oath of office, the hostages were freed. The next day's headline beamed across the New York Times. It said, quote, Reagan takes office as 40th president, promises an era of national renewal. Minutes later, 52 U.S. hostages in Iran fly to freedom after 444-day ordeal. Quite a headline. It has long been a source of debate, controversy, and even conspiracy as to what exactly the incoming Reagan team and president might have done to precipitate that hostage release. Personally, I've written about it for years in books and articles. And this commentary here isn't the place to take a deep dive. But more to my point in this commentary, Ronald Reagan, like Donald Trump, made threats to the hostage takers. In March 1980, Reagan publicly stated that the United States should issue a deadline for the hostages' release and take quote-unquote unpleasant action against Iran if the deadline was not met. Like Donald Trump today, Ronald Reagan didn't describe what that action might look like. He didn't need to. In December 1980, Reagan explicitly warned, quote, there should be no delay in freeing the hostages, unquote. It turned out that the Iranians listened. There was no delay whatsoever. In fact, again, they freed the hostages immediately as Ronald Reagan was being sworn in. One could argue that the hostage situation with Hamas today is actually far worse than the Iranian crisis in 1979 to 1981, in this very humanitarian respect. Though the U.S. hostages in Iran were bound and tied and not treated well, they weren't tortured. Conversely, the Hamas hostages today have been beaten, raped, brutalized, killed. The Hamas captors are savages. Donald Trump acknowledged exactly that in his press conference on January 6th. And so, like Ronald Reagan, he wants a release of the hostages very soon. He set a deadline, January 20th, 2025, not unlike January 20th, 1981. If the hostages aren't freed, Donald Trump vows, all hell will break loose. What that looks like remains to be seen. Things could get very interesting very soon. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMRV AM and FM in Fayetteville, North Carolina, along with WMIR FM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.